Section 2. Reducing the role of money to improve the quality of American democracy. The Buckley genre has lowered the quality of American democracy, placing wealthy conservative families at the center of American politics. The fittest 50 mimic the canny pigs in George Orwell's Animal Farm, dominating politics in order to disproportionately glean economic gains. Here is David K. Johnston reflecting on the Buckley era. The system today is not promoting prosperity based on individual enterprise and thriftiness. It is, instead, working, as all socialist redistributional schemes do, to enrich and benefit those who have access to the levers of power. In America, that is the political donor class. This section examines the characteristics of the Buckley genre, beginning with the overt partisan character of the Supreme Court. It includes the court's rejection of political equality, which is the global gold standard for democracy, as well as its rejection of the founding fathers and framers' deep concerns over vote buying. The section concludes with a review of how the GOP's embrace of pay-to-play has diminished faith domestically and abroad in the American versions of both democracy and capitalism. Chapter 5. The Roberts Republicans, a partisan court of Sumner Darwinians. The Supreme Court is not an ordinary court, but a political court, or more precisely, a politicized court, which is to say, a court strongly influenced in making its decisions by the political beliefs of the judges. Chicago Federal Appeals Court Judge Richard A. Posner, March 2016. There's just such a control of government by the wealthy that whatever happens, it's not working for all the people. It's working for a few of the people. Stanley Greenberg, Pollster, August 2011. The rise of the fittest 50 is rooted in an unprecedented partisan divide on the Supreme Court. Beginning with the Burger Court, justices appointed by Republican presidents have outvoted mostly Democratic appointees to rule repeatedly in suits involving the political system in favor of William Graham Sumner's fittest. The preferences of higher-income Americans, financiers, and CEOs have always been important to public officials. Many are employers, entrepreneurs, and community leaders who can create jobs. They are traditionally important cogs in society, and their concerns warrant attention. But a cult-like devotion to the fittest among justices has come to characterize the Buckley era. Ideological divides within the Supreme Court aren't new. But law professors Neil Devins of William & Mary, Lawrence Baum of Ohio State University, and Richard Hassan of the University of California, Irvine, document that the Roberts Court's partisan split is unprecedented. Its Republican appointees have proven far more eager than Democratic appointees to accommodate the GOP's allies in moneyed circles, especially after Justice Samuel Alito replaced the centrist Justice O'Connor in 2006. Jeffrey Rosen, writing in the New York Times Magazine in March 2008, concluded that the ensuing partisan divide was no accident. It represents the culmination of a carefully planned behind-the-scenes campaign over several decades to change not only the courts, but also the country's political culture. A wide partisan gap now separates Democratic and Republican justices on the key issues of voting rights and pay-to-play that bear directly on the equality and the sovereignty of voters, and thus the quality of American democracy. The 2017 appointment of Justice Neil Gorsuch ensures that the Roberts Republicans can muster majorities to continue cosseting the already comfortable by disenfranchising Democratic voters and continuing to legitimize political bribery. A judicial partisan divide is widely acknowledged. Today's Republicans are essentially saying the court is nothing but another political body, is how a New York Times editorial described it. The increasingly political nature of federal courts is exemplified by the refusal of GOP senators to consider the nomination of Merrick Garland or numerous other Obama judicial nominees once they regained a majority in the 2014 elections. Republican senators confirmed only 28% of judicial nominees during the last 2 years of the Obama administration. That provided President Trump with well over 100 federal judgeships to fill upon taking office, sufficient to notably tilt federal courts to the right. In contrast, 67% of George W. Bush appointees in his last 2 years were confirmed by the then Democratic majority in the Senate, leaving Barack Obama with only 53 vacancies to fill. Between vacancies and mandatory retirements, President Trump is likely to appoint nearly one half of appellate seats by 2020, the powerful courts immediately below the Supreme Court that decide thousands of cases annually. That prospect greatly pleases Google, Chevron, and the Fittest 50, including the Scaife Family Foundation, Sheldon Adelson, the Kochs, and the Mercers, who have donated tens of millions of dollars to the Federalist Society and the Judicial Crisis Network, managing this methodical and successful transformation to a partisan Republican federal judiciary. The transformation has succeeded, as noted earlier, because majorities of the Berger, Rehnquist, and Roberts courts accountable for the Buckley genre have ignored nearly two centuries of precedent. Their logic perhaps draws from the sentiments of conservatives such as Ed Whelan. He is president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center that provided guidance to Republican senators who refused to debate or vote during 2016 on Merrick Garland. Whelan argues that adherence to original intent needs to be situationally rejected, that is, supplemented, when that methodology fails to yield a sufficiently clear answer to a constitutional question. The leading American conservative jurist and retired federal appeals court judge Richard Posner has argued that such malleable principles have tarred the Roberts Court in particular as a politicized court, which is to say, a court strongly influenced in making its decisions by the political beliefs of the judges. The late Justice Scalia, for instance, asserted originalism as justification for his refusal to recognize new rights for Americans, such as marriage equality. Yet his perception of originalism was sufficiently malleable to extend religious rights to corporations, to permit corporations to buy legislators' votes, and to permit GOP officials to shrink Black voting rights despite the 14th Amendment. Chief Justice Roberts objects to Posner, insisting any partisan bias of his court is merely impressionistic, colored by the increasingly politicized confirmation process. Judges are not politicians, even when they come to the bench by way of the ballot. This assertion is belied by a number of rulings by Roberts Republicans that constitutionally embraced state laws that disproportionately suppress the votes of Democrats. Crawford v. Marion County, Indiana Election Board in 2008 shielded spurious voter ID laws, while Shelby County v. Holder in 2013 weakened the Voting Rights Act. The Roberts Court's embrace of Democratic voter suppression. Voter purges and voter ID laws imposed by Republican state election officials in the wake of Crawford reduced the Black and Latino franchises in nearly every southern state, and others like Iowa, Kansas, and Wisconsin, creating the greatest suppression of minority voters since Jim Crow. That is why Posner has concluded that Crawford is widely regarded as a means of voter suppression rather than of fraud prevention. In Texas, for instance, Crawford permitted GOP state officials to reinstall de facto poll taxes, with rules burdening some voters with the need to travel hundreds of miles to obtain newly demanded IDs. The potential disenfranchisement is huge. A federal court in Texas found that 608,470 registered voters lacked the IDs that Crawford required. They tend to be poor, elderly, and minorities who vote disproportionately for Democrats. In Iowa, new voter ID laws enacted by GOP officials in 2017 potentially exclude 11%, 260,000, of eligible voters. As elsewhere, minority voters trending Democratic were targeted. In Black Hawk County, Waterloo, for instance, blacks comprised 27% of eligible voters without requisite IDs, but comprise only 10% of county-eligible voters. The GOP also eliminated same-day registration and the ballot option of party-line voting, despite acknowledging that voter fraud was non-existent. Not one case of voter impersonation occurred among the 1.6 million votes cast in 2016, for instance. These suppression tactics proved highly effective. Voter turnout rose 1.3% from 2012 to 2016 in states not imposing voter ID restrictions. In contrast, turnout in states including Mississippi, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin that imposed new voter ID laws in the wake of Crawford and Shelby fell 1.7%. Moreover, these suppression laws proved to be artfully crafted, disenfranchisement falling most heavily among minorities leaning Democratic. Turnout in counties where blacks comprised up to 40% of voters rose 0.8% in 2016 in states without voter ID restrictions. In contrast, turnout in such counties and states with new voter ID laws fell 2.5% in 2016. The drop was an even larger 5% in counties with new ID laws where blacks comprised more than 40% of voters. In Wisconsin, state voter ID restrictions by Republican lawmakers contributed to a 41,000 drop in turnout between 2012 and 2016 in mostly minority Milwaukee. Statewide, a study by Priorities USA found that turnout dropped by 200,000. That almost certainly flipped the state to Donald Trump in 2016, whose winning margin was just 22,748. It is reminiscent of Gore Bush in 2000. While the Supreme Court famously and inappropriately stopped the Florida recount, that count was only necessary because 12,000 predominantly black voters had been erroneously purged by Republican officials. Crawford and the Buckley genre share a disregard by Republican Supreme Court jurists of prior jurisprudence or substantive law, an absence of factual grounding, and a justification in each instance by the introduction of novel legal arguments lacking underpinnings in established legal doctrine. In Citizens United, for instance, the Roberts Republicans could not cite a single precedent involving First Amendment speech rights of for-profit corporations. Not one. In its Buckley genre rulings, the Berger, Rehnquist, and Roberts courts could not cite a single precedent in the canons of American law where vote buying had previously been constitutionally shielded or decriminalized. Not one. And in Crawford, the Roberts Republicans could not identify one instance of voter identity fraud in the entire history of Indiana. Not one. In-person voter fraud is virtually non-existent, an awkward fact for Roberts Republicans. Their insistence that state officials enacting voter ID laws are nonetheless meeting the spirit and letter of the Constitution would have made the 19th century Justice Joseph McKenna proud. Read on. Of course, the Buckley genre is not the first skein of Supreme Court rulings embracing voter inequality grounded in contrived, dubious, or fallacious legal thinking. The Jim Crow era of Supreme Court decisions stripping constitutional protections for black Americans began with the Slaughterhouse ruling in 1873. Justice John Marshall Harlan later charged that his predecessors favoring Jim Crow utilized sham legal reasoning to justify this and subsequent rulings weakening the 14th Amendment. Similarly, the Roberts Republicans' support for sham voter ID laws in Crawford rather precisely mimics the Fuller Court's Williams v. Mississippi 1898 ruling. It held that election officials in Mississippi were not attempting to disenfranchise its 907,000 black voters with literacy tests. Justice Joseph McKenna's majority opinion at the time asserted, "The Constitution of Mississippi and its statutes do not on their face discriminate between the races, and it has not been shown that their actual administration was evil, only that evil was possible under them." Justice McKenna and the Fuller Court's writ included Alabama, where delighted elites rushed to draft a new 1901 constitution to ensure white supremacy in this state against the menace of Negro domination. It barred voting by anyone convicted of crimes involving moral turpitude. The definition of that term was left to local voting registrars. And it included Louisiana, where only 1,700 out of 700,000 eligible blacks were permitted to vote in 1900. By 1904, only 1,342 were even allowed to register. Much of Justice McKenna's opinion stood as writ on black and immigrant voting rights until the 1960s. How evil was the Fuller Court's writ? Most telling is that Adolf Hitler sought to normalize the racist Nazi Nuremberg laws that presaged the Holocaust by analogizing them with the Jim Crow era, including its weekly lynchings. As Yale law professor James Whitman has noted, Mein Kampf lauds Jim Crow, and Nazi propagandists later touted to Germans the precedent of America's racist politics and policies featuring special laws directed against the Negroes, which limit their voting rights, freedom of movement, and career possibilities. Whitman quotes one Nazi who wrote, "What is lynch justice if not the natural resistance of the folk to an alien race that is attempting to gain the upper hand?" The pernicious Crawford and Shelby County rulings have compromised the Robert Court's prestige and authority. Their ancestry is the poisonous tree of the racist Williams ruling. All three decisions empowered discrimination among voters by partisan state electoral officials. Adding to their discomfiture is a failure to remove the last vestiges of Jim Crow. The Roberts Republicans permit the disenfranchisement of Democratic-leaning citizens in states like Alabama, where 20% of blacks are denied the vote as felons, many convicted for non-crimes including, yes, moral turpitude. The consequence is dramatized by Virginia Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe, who, despite apoplectic Republican lawmakers, restored voting rights to 156,000 former felons in recent years, helping turn a red state purple. University of Texas law professor Justin Driver summarizes, "An undesirable consequence of the court's partisan divide is that it becomes increasingly difficult to contend with a straight face that constitutional law is not simply politics by other means, and that justices are not merely politicians clad in fine robes." Indeed, Supreme Court reporter Robert Barnes notes that virtually all Supreme Court justices of late are the product of a highly politicized process. The thing that separates all the smart lawyers who would like to become federal judges from the ones who actually become judges is most often political connections, involvement in ideological causes, political campaigns, and conservative or liberal organizations acts as a sieve. It separates out those who are chosen by the political elite for lifetime appointments. The Roberts Republicans embrace the fittest. The court's partisan divide has been documented by legal journalist Adam Liptak of the New York Times. Over the long sweep of American history, only two of the 382 most important court rulings between 1790 and 2010 broke along party lines. Since 2010, however, at least seven such important rulings have broken along partisan lines, including rulings on voting rights, campaign finance, mandatory customer, client, and patient arbitration, immigration, and strip searches. That partisan divide has since expanded to also include union agency fees in Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, 2016. Partisanship is also evident in Roberts Republican rulings involving major economic interests, corporate behavior, or clashes between economically upscale and downscale citizens. As summarized by David K. Johnson in his book Free Lunch, the Roberts Republicans take from the many to cosset the few, while stripping grievances voiced by the many of judicial standing. A landmark 2013 statistical analysis by Professors Lee Epstein, William Landis, and Judge Posner, examined votes by the 36 Supreme Court justices who had served during the prior 65 years. The five Republican appointees sitting on the Roberts Court in 2013 were among the 10 justices during that period whose rulings most closely hewed to business positions. And the two most obsequious of all 36 justices are Roberts and Alito. Judge Neil Gorsuch will very likely make a triumvirate. The Roberts Republicans have rejected the founding principles of their Republican Party as asserted by Abraham Lincoln in 1859. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital could never have existed without labor. Labor is the superior, greatly the superior, of capital. Specific examples abound. Roberts Republicans have ruled that corporate officials need not obtain shareholder approval for corporate political donations. Knox versus Service Employees International Union, Local 1000. Yet, union officials are required to obtain prior approval of political donations from each individual member. Interestingly, this right for CEOs to divert investor or shareholder money to ingratiate and gain political access is viewed askance by many in the American business community itself. A 2012 survey of that sector by the Corporate Reform Coalition found 71% of respondents supported requiring firms to only spend money on political campaigns if they get approval from their shareholders first. The same proportion of self-identified Republican respondents agreed. Other Roberts Court rulings favoring the fittest include Gross versus FBL Financial Services, 2009. Firms are largely impervious to age discrimination lawsuits. Walmart versus Dukes, 2011, and AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion, 2011. Corporations are permitted to restrict access to the courts by aggrieved customers, patients, or employees, instead insisting on arbitration. That is, firms can sue employees, patients, clients, and customers in court, but simultaneously force those possibly victimized by corporate actions into arbitration, blocking their access to the justice system for class action suits. In the year following these rulings, there was a doubling of firms banning class action lawsuits in their user agreements with employees, customers, and others. Janus Capital Group versus First Derivative Traders, 2011. Immaculate fraud. Use of a shell entity by mutual funds prevents prosecution of the funds for defrauding clients. By completing some buy or sell orders on behalf of favored clients at the expense of other clients. Comcast versus Barrett, 2013. Comcast was shielded from prosecution for overcharging its Philadelphia customers by $875 million. RJR Nabisco Incorporated versus the European Community, 2016. Tobacco firms smuggling cigarettes to Europe and participating in international money laundering enterprises cannot be sued by European nations or the European Community. As the scope of these rulings indicates, the Roberts Republicans have been quite energetic in providing a broad constitutional shield for the actions of the fittest 50 and corporations. That reflects, in part, the fruits of a deft legal stratagem pursued by a variety of private attorneys funded by the fittest 50. Led by corporate enthusiasts such as James Bopp Jr., a host of Republican groups have become serial filers of lawsuits cosseting the powerful. Many alleging violation of ephemeral or mythical corporate First Amendment rights. Their model is to run suits en masse past the Roberts Republicans to see what sticks, court conservatives opportunistically picking and choosing cases to hear. The Roberts Republicans have also been proactive on their own initiative. Most notably, they demanded an unusual re-argument of the initial March 2009 Citizens United case in order to justify their eventual ruling that went considerably beyond the original complaint. As former Justice John Paul Stevens explained, five justices were unhappy with the limited nature of the case before us, so they changed the case to give themselves an opportunity to change the law. exemplified by Crawford and the Buckley genre, rulings that have transformed the architecture of American politics have been instituted by Republican jurists on a foundation of sand. In the fullness of time, they are likely to be reversed. Just ask the CEO of Dow Chemical. Shortly after the death of Justice Scalia, that firm abruptly paid $835 million to settle a long-standing price-fixing conviction in a class-action suit. Until then, they had every reason to believe the Roberts Republicans would intervene and overturn the appeals court verdict against them, just as they had done in other similar instances.